The opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily represent those of the management of KUCI or the UC Board of Regents. For more information about this show, go to kuci.org. You are listening to KUCI 88.9 in Irvine. Welcome to In the Garden with UCC Master Gardeners. I am Katrina Kirkaby, your Master Gardener host today. Today we're going to talk about a very small but treacherous bug and fungus. The pest is called Prolithicus shot hole borer. It vectors two fungi, Fusarium and Graphophyllum, which are killing trees in Southern California. There is over 1,000 infected trees here at UCI with this bug and fungus, and the number of trees that will need to be removed is being determined at this time. This pest complex is not limited to UCI and is spreading throughout Southern California. The effects of this borer and fungus will change our landscape for generations. Today, we are fortunate to have with us Dr. John Kabashima. Dr. Kabashima is the Environmental Horticulture Advisor for the University of California Cooperative Extension South Coast Research and Extension Center here in Irvine. Part of his job is to help identify and develop controls for exotic pests. He is here today to tell us about the Prolithicus shot hole borer. What is it, how it affects us, and what we should be aware of. Welcome, Doctor.
Thank you.
What is this shot hole borer, and how is it causing so much damage to our trees?
The Prolithicus shot hole borer is part of a group of small beetles called ambrosia beetles. And the ambrosia beetles tend to carry a fungus with them. In this case, the Prolithicus shot hole borer is carrying a couple of fungus, Fusarium and Graphium, and as the female makes her galleries so she can lay her eggs and raise young beetles, the fungus grows on the walls of the galleries, the little tunnels. The beetle actually doesn't feed on the tree, it feeds on the fungus. And the fungus feeds on the tree and then disrupts the vessels that move water and food up and down the tree in the cambial layer, and that eventually ends up killing the tree if the tree is susceptible.
What trees are being damaged by this?
When this beetle initially landed in Los Angeles County, unfortunately, it did become established in several of the arboretum, like the Los Angeles Arboretum and the Huntington Library's Arboretum. Because of that, we actually know that it attacked over 300 species of trees and was able to infect about 100 plus species with the fungus. And we now know that there are 37 trees that are reproductive hosts, which means that the beetle can reproduce and the fungus can successfully attack the tree.
At what stage do trees need to be removed or treated if they are infected?
Because we've only been working on this for a few years, there's more unanswered questions than answers. What we've tried to do over time through observation and some initial research is come up with ways of assessing the damage to various trees and what decisions we need to make in terms of management. The problem we have here is this beetle is new to North America. Once we saw the beetle initially, it was identified using standard morphological taxonomic keys where we just looked at the physical characteristics of the beetle and gave it a identification. In this case, it was It was identified as the T shot hole borer initially in the early 2000s. Once we realized that there was another beetle causing significant damage to avocados in Israel, scientists here, in particular Dr. Akif Eskelin, started looking for another beetle called the Polyphagus shot hole borer. At that time, it didn't have that name, and ran DNA analysis on an avocado tree that was infected with the fusarium and the beetle. And the DNA, even though the beetle looked identical to the T-shot hole borer, the DNA showed that it was indeed a different species, unknown and undescribed in science. We know that it probably is very closely related to T-shot hole borer, so that gave us a clue that it probably came from Southeast Asia. Once we identified that beetle as a new species and a new species carrying two new species of fungi, we realized that what would happen is the classic case of a new species arriving into a new environment and being faced with all these new hosts. So what the beetle did is it basically was in an alien environment, and it started tasting every tree in the arboretums. So we know that it tried to attack over 300 species. It only successfully infected over 100 species with the fusarium.
Only.
And it only was able to reproduce in what we know now to be 37. Initially, the list was about 20. But as the beetle populations start to increase, the beetle that maybe a few attacks on the tree might resist it. But once we have hundreds of thousands of beetles in the vicinity and they start attacking trees, then the plants that were somewhat resistant, their resistance can be overcome by sheer numbers of beetles attacking and infecting it with, you know, hundreds or thousands attacks by this fungi into the tree. So as the beetle population has increased, we have found that the list of reproductive hosts have increased, and we are now at the number 37.
Wow, this is really incredible. What can be done?
Right now, what needs to be done is a great deal of basic science. When you're working with a new exotic or invasive species, and basically we know nothing about what its behavior is going to be in this new environment, what we do is we number one, try to figure out where it came from, and that, as I said, was Southeast Asia. And we send scientists back to the country of origin to try to see what it's doing there. That was funded by USDA, the Farm Bill, and the California Avocado Commission. So we sent several scientists along with the botanist from the Huntington, and they went through Vietnam, which is initially the country we thought it came from, and looked for the beetle. Normally on these foreign explorations, you're looking for the host material the beetle feeds on and any organisms that might be associated with it in terms of biological control. When they went to Vietnam, what they found was that the beetles were most commonly found in acacia plantations. They grow acacia for wood and paper products over there. So they created this huge monoculture of a plant that the beetles could successfully attack and reproduce in. And that's where they found it. They also found it in the countryside, but it was very difficult to find. And they have not been able to process all of these collections to determine if there's a biocontrol. But right now, nothing obvious is jumping out at us as a very important biocontrol in the country of origin. since that first trip, there was a second trip to Southeast Asia because we had a second invasion of Polyphagus shot-hole borer in San Diego County. And this second invasion, when the DNA analysis was done, turned out to be slightly different from the Los Angeles County invasion. So we have two separate invasions, two separate populations, and each slightly different from each other. So the second trip, the second foreign exploration, was including now Taiwan, China, and Vietnam, because the San Diego invasion is possibly from the Taiwan area, and the Los Angeles County invasion is from the Vietnam-China area.
And how long ago did you say they first discovered these here in California?
The first initial find was in 2003 of what we think might have been Polyphagus shot-hole borer. But at the time, nobody even suspected that there might be a new species, and the DNA analysis was not conducted. Subsequent to that, there was another invasion in Long Beach, I believe in 2010. And that was on some box elder trees in the neighborhood. And they initially thought it was T. shot-hole borer. And they observed the trees and saw that the following year, some of the trees had recovered. In retrospect, that recovery was probably because we had low populations. And the populations had not increased to the level that could successfully attack and kill a tree. That takes approximately 8 generations to generate those numbers. And that, in this climate, could be 2 to 3 years. So the fact that some of the trees seem to recover the next year is, in retrospect, probably because we had low populations. Once the populations increased, then we started seeing tree death. And when we look at the invasions into the Los Angeles Arboretum, the UCLA Arboretum, Huntington Library, we're dealing with high populations. There we're seeing quite a few trees that are dying.
I was walking through UCI yesterday, and I could see tree, and now what I know what I'm looking for, I could see tree after tree after tree that's been infected. How long do you think it's been there or been here?
We think the UCI infestation is fairly recent. The other problem we have with this is that trees, especially during drought years, often exhibit symptoms of stress, and people can easily miss new pests like this because they're already used to the fact that the trees are under some type of drought stress. And when you see symptoms on a tree of decline, you assume it's something else. Once you look closely and you know what to look for, then it becomes quite obvious that this is Polyphagus shot-hole borer and the associated fungi.
You know, as you're bringing that up, is there a website or is there a place we could go to see what it looks like so we could identify them for ourselves, possibly in our yard or when we're out in parks?
There are two websites. One is the website at the University of California, Riverside, and that is the lab of Dr. Akif Eskelin. The website there is eskalenlab, that's Eskelin Lab, .ucr.edu. The second website available is pshb.org. So pshb is in Polyphagus shot-hole borer, .org. And that is the Orange County website. For residents of Orange County, if you suspect that you have a infested tree, you can go to that website and look at the leaflets and information on the website, and that will help you to determine whether or not it's Polyphagus shot-hole borer. If you suspect it's Polyphagus shot-hole borer, there are instructions there on how to take photographs of the tree, and we like a photograph of the whole tree, a little bit of a close-up of the trunk, and then a very close-up of the hole, and there should be a hole if there's prolificus shot hole borer, and you put a tip of a ballpoint pen by the hole so that we can have some sense of scale. There are a lot of beetles that attack trees, and especially during drought years. The size of the hole and the shape often can help us to determine whether it is or isn't prolificus shot hole borer. If the photograph, and it needs to be in focus, if the photograph shows us that it is probably prolificus shot hole borer, then we can go out and confirm that, or we can ask people to send samples. But we will make that decision based on the photographs.
Now, is that something you would like to have people sending in? Would that help your research out at all, finding out where it might be, finding out how far it's spread? Is that something the community could help with?
Yes. One thing that the community needs to understand is that there's very little funding to conduct this type of survey work, and so the photographs are critical. If it's not prolificus shot hole borer, we do not have the time to go out and try to figure out what it is. Right now, we're so busy just confirming what's out there and conducting the research to try to control this that we really would ask people to make sure that they look at all the literature, take the photographs, and only send it in if they think it's the prolificus shot hole borer. That way, we maximize our time, and we're more efficient.
Great. Doctor, could you give those web addresses out again? Sometimes people are driving and need a little bit of time to pull over and pull out a pen and paper.
Sure. The first one is escalenlab.ucr.edu. So that's escalenlab.ucr.edu. And the second one is pshb.org, as in prolificus shot hole borer.org.
And if that's too much for people to remember, they could always go to our website and to our helpline, which is uccemg.com, and you could ask that information for the email address. We're really helpful in our hotline. Our website is www.uccemg.com, and our hotline, where you could actually write in at, is hotline, it's HOTLINE, at uccemg.com. UCC, excuse me, it's hotline, HOTLINE, at uccemg.com. So we could really use our community to help out with this invasive pests that's just pretty much going everywhere right now.
Correct. And we are doing surveys, and we are conducting some research. And what's happening right now is initially when we were informing people of this problem, they didn't have the problem. We were trying to be proactive. And when people don't have a problem, they kind of file it in the back of their mind and don't really do much about it.
Not my backyard.
And now that it's killing thousands of trees, and these are large, mature trees that are quite expensive to remove, they are all of a sudden wanting information. So our work right now is to start developing the tools we need to address this issue. And one of the first tools that we're developing currently with UCI, UCI is trying to survey all of their trees and then assess them. So we've been working with them on developing a matrix that they can use when they're looking at the trees to determine whether or not they need to take some type of action. And the first thing that we've done is we've looked at host species. So we know what some of the reproductive hosts are, and we know what non-reproductive hosts are. A non-reproductive host is a tree that's really not suitable for the beetles to reproduce in or for the fungus to attack. And there are quite a few of those, fortunately. The reproductive host species that we know of now number 37, and they include agricultural trees like avocados. They include quite a few of our landscape trees, such as sycamores and willows and maples and box elder. And then they include a lot of trees that are in the natural environment, like the willows and the cottonwoods and the oaks and the sycamores. So this affects everybody. Then we're looking at host value, and we kind of came up with a low and high host value.
Could you tell us what that is?
Host value is like low would be a species of low economic value, a small tree, a young tree. So it's either not worth a lot or it's not very valuable yet. A host tree that has a high value would be a species of high economic value or cultural value, like a heritage tree, something that was dedicated and has been there for, you know, decades. They tend to be larger trees or older trees because the older a tree gets, the more valuable it becomes. Some of these trees in the landscape, if you look at value to the real estate, are worth thousands of dollars. I mean, many of these oaks and large sycamores can easily be worth $10,000 or more. And then we look at the hazard level, and that would be hazard primarily to people or property. Low hazard would mean that it's not a hazard to any structure or to people. A high hazard tree would be one that poses a high risk to people or property, and that would be trees that are adjacent to walkways or playgrounds or high-use lawn areas, in parking lots where branches can drop on cars, where the tree might be next to a structure and could fall over and damage the structure. So that's a high hazard, high value tree. Then we look at the infestation level on the tree in terms of the number of attacks from the beetle. And also we look at whether or not we're seeing symptoms of dieback on the tree. So a low level infestation would be looking at a tree and counting the number of attacks on the tree. If it's less than 30 with no dieback, we consider that a low level infestation. If it has greater than 30 but less than 150 attacks on the tree, which would show up as the tiny entry holes that are about the size of a tip of a ballpoint pen, and there's no dieback, that's considered moderate. If it has greater than 150 attacks on the tree with no dieback, that's considered a heavy infestation. And if you have greater than 150 attacks on the tree and there's dieback, then that's considered severe. Our recommendation is that trees that are either heavily or severely infested should be removed. And the matrix then factors in, is it a high-value tree, and is it going to be potentially dangerous to people or structures?
Gotcha. Now, once you determine this, what can be done?
Well, UCI is already removing some trees that are severely or heavily infested. Much of the reason is because of the hazard to people, to students. Trees that are moderately or have a low level of infestation can be treated with pesticides. And we are actually preparing to conduct a large pesticide trial to screen out different methods and chemicals. So we're looking at insecticides and we're looking at fungicides. We're looking at spraying it on the bark, drenching it in the soil, injecting it into the tree, because when you get into a real-life situation, it's not enough to know what will kill the insect or the fungus. You also have to understand that each situation has unique challenges. So if you have a tree that's being planted in the middle of a lawn and you have irrigation from the lawn hitting the bark of the tree, it may not be ideal to use a bark barrier treatment. You may want to inject an insecticide into the tree. If you have areas where there's a potential that people would be, you know, climbing on the tree and having direct contact with it. You may not want an insecticide barrier on a tree. May you want something that's injected into the tree so that it doesn't contact other organisms. Like I say, so many different situations out there that we need to test all the different combinations of insecticides, fungicides, and application methods, because it's basically we're working towards an integrated pest management approach. The first approach is, and this is also one of the research things that we have to document, is it seems that this beetle and fungus primarily attack irrigated trees. So trees that are under drought stress do not seem to be attacked. It's mostly in irrigated trees.
Like our yards and our universities,
right,
and our parks.
And we think that's because it's an ambrosia beetle and it has to grow the fungus. So if you have a tree that has a lot of water in the xylem and a lot of water in the wood tissue, a fungus is going to grow much better there than in a drought-stressed tree where the wood is drier and there's less water in the vessels. So that observation is going to be documented. And if we find that that is, in fact, the case, which anecdotally it looks like it is, the first thing you would do in an IPM program is use a cultural practice of reducing water to that tree. So you would water the tree infrequently. You would water it so that you wet the first 1 or 2 feet of soil where the roots are. And then you would let that tree slowly take that water up out of the soil and then replace it when that water has been used up.
Is that something we should start practicing for trees that we have now that are at high risk, so to speak, that are in our yards, is maybe a little less water, or do we just continue for now as we're going?
Well,
irrigating
trees has been a problem for decades. And the problem we have in the landscape is, unlike nature, where the trees get water certain times of the year and water percolates quite deep, tree roots in nature in a healthy forest go down quite deep. And so they can actually bring that water up from the ground over long periods of time. And then they're adapted. If you're a native tree, you're adapted to the dry summers. In the landscape, what we tend to find is that many trees are grown in turf grass, and they're irrigated with the turf grass. Turf grass is normally irrigated to a depth of about 6 to 10 inches. Tree roots can go down 2 to 3 feet. So when we water trees in turf grass and we don't also water for the trees periodically, you're forcing the tree roots to go from 2 to 3 feet up to the top 6 to 10 inches of soil to get the water that's being applied for the turf grass. If you really, really wanted to water trees correctly, you would every so often do a deep watering for the trees, and then you can go back to your, you know, normal turf irrigation, but you periodically have to refill that reservoir in the soil for the tree so that you encourage the deep rooting. Deep rooting means that those trees are not going to be as affected by changes in climate. So if we get a hot day and the tree has 2 to 3 feet of root zone that has water in it, that is not going to be affected by daily changes in weather. Whereas if the tree has its roots in the top 6 to 10 inches, changes in weather can rapidly deplete that and affect the ability of the plant to get water. So appropriately watering trees really helps them to be healthier and helps them to withstand the Southern California climate.
Great piece of information. We need to take just a quick moment and let our listeners know that the opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily represent those of the management of KUCI or the UC Board of Regents. For more information about this show, go to kuci.org. You are listening to KUCI 88.9 in Irvine. Wow, we're learning a lot about this. Where do we go from here? What else can we find out about this? Is there any known natural enemies of?
Right now, we have not done very well in terms of finding a natural enemy. We are looking at some bacteria that Dr. Eskelin has been working with in his lab. He's been sampling bacteria from trees, and he found a bacillus that seems to be antagonistic to the fungi. So he is working with that, and one of the experiments that he's been doing in the laboratory in the greenhouse is injecting the bacteria into the water conducting vessels of the tree and seeing if that would be antagonistic to the fungi as it tries to get in. There is a whole gamut of products on the market. There is one bacillus on the market. We have no idea if that would work, but we are preparing to conduct a comprehensive trial at UCI sometime in June. And we will be testing many of these things to see if there's any effect. And when we do those tests, what we do is we look at a untreated tree, and that's one of our treatments, and then we will compare all the treatments to the untreated tree to see if there's any significant difference between no treatment and a treatment. And then we will be comparing treatments to each other to see if one is better than the other.
Gotcha. So we're fairly in the beginning stages of studying this and finding out what the causes are and how to control it. And I'm sure in the future we'll probably be doing another show once you have all these answers back and telling us a little bit more definitively what we can do and what we can't do once you have some results of these tests.
Yes, I could tell. But one thing I can tell you now is that some of the initial testing that was done and funded by the California Avocado Commission, then the California Association of Nurseries and Garden Centers, and the Nursery Growers Association also helped. They looked at ways of handling the tree after you cut it down. And one of the things that Dr. Tim Payne at UCR found is that if you chip the wood to 1 inch or less, that will kill the beetle. So if you remove a tree, you should chip that wood, and that will kill the beetle, but not necessarily the fungus. So then he did another series of tests where he solarized the wood. He put it underneath clear plastic, thick 6 mil plastic, and he left it out all summer. And solarization killed the fungus and the beetles. The other thing that works is to compost it. So properly composted wood will kill the beetle and the fungus. Improperly composted wood will not it will not kill the beetle or the fungus.
And you could potentially help spread it.
Right. And the other thing is not moving wood around. So if you cut a tree or cut wood from a tree, you need to either solarize the wood. You can solarize the logs, you can chip it and solarize that, you can compost it, but don't take cut limbs or wood and transport it anywhere else, because the beetles are still in the wood, and if you haven't done anything to kill them, then they can fly out and reinfest trees. We think that's one of the ways that it moved so quickly, is that people were cutting wood, maybe putting it on the back of a pickup, driving to someplace, having their truck parked there, and then having the beetles fly out. We know in one case, or we strongly suspect, that there was an area where they were actually taking all their green waste, and then they would collect it, and then at the end of the week, they would gather it all and take it to the dump. while trees near that area where they were collecting the green waste were infected with the fungus. So we think that that was another way. So handling, proper handling of green waste, proper handling of wood are really important in not spreading this.
And how would our listeners find out what the proper way is?
If you go to our PSHB,
would you tell us that again?
PSHB.org, PSHB.org, or to the EscalenLab.ucr.edu websites, we have instructions on how to properly handle infected wood.
So this is really, really important aspect of it is we need to control it where it is and not be spreading it to other parts of the state or city.
Correct.
And those of us who like to go camping during the summertime, would you suggest getting your firewood there, wherever you're camping, and not bring it from home?
Right now, this is not the only beetle that's being spread by firewood. There's another one, the gold-spotted oak borer, which has recently been found in Orange County and Weir Canyon, and it's killed thousands of trees in San Diego County, primarily spread by firewood. So there is a campaign that says, burn it where you buy it. So buy locally sourced wood and do not transport wood from one area to another because you will potentially be carrying some type of organism into a new area.
Our lives are changing. The world is getting smaller and we are bringing much more biodiversity in, if we like it or not. We now have to be much more mindful of what we're doing as individuals.
Prior to 1987, we would say there would be a new exotic or invasive species introduced into California every 60 days. And recently, some scientists took a look at the data, and they're saying that we get a new exotic or invasive species in California every 45 days. That is a function of increased travel, increased trade, increased tourism, higher density population, bringing plants in from all over the world, and overwatering and overfertilizing. So the reality today is that if you travel someplace and you decide you want to grab a little piece of a plant and bring it back with you, you're potentially bringing back some type of hitchhiker in that plant. Unless you're a trained entomologist or plant pathologist, you probably will not know if there's anything on there. And that's why you need to buy from licensed nurseries, or you need to make sure that the plant material you're bringing over has been inspected and certified by that state or country for transport to the United States.
How widespread is it right now?
The Pelifica shot-hole borer, from a small initial population in L.A. County in the early 2000s, is now throughout L.A. County. It's in a small portion of Riverside and San Bernardino County. It's throughout Orange County. And now we have a population in San Diego County. So this has become quite widespread.
And with so many more trees infected, it's much easier to carry it to other places now.
The population levels now, remember I talked to you about the eight generations?
Mm-hmm.
After this has been around for 2 or 3 years, the populations can go from one beetle in eight generations. She can produce about 100,000 progeny. One beetle.
Could you say that one more time so it can sink in?
So if you have one beetle in eight generations, she can potentially lay eggs and raise young that would go from one to close to 100,000. You multiply that by thousands of beetles, and you can see why now we're starting to see tree death and tree decline, because it's been a couple of years, or 2 or 3 years, Now you're getting the populations that are high enough to do substantial damage.
Gotcha. You mentioned earlier about if you see the damage, and you could be injected or something could be put on the tree, do they contact a professional company to do that? How do they go about doing that, or is that even on the market yet to be done to a private residence?
Well, right now, if you have one of the reproductive hosts and you confirm that you have polyphagous shot hole borer, and especially if there's known infestations in the surrounding areas or adjacent areas, then you should call a arborist. That's a licensed applicator, or you can call a company that's licensed to apply pesticides, and they can do treatments, whether it's, you know, a bark spray or an injection. Many of the products are restricted, or to spray a large tree, you need to have professional application equipment. So I would say very few people could probably treat their own tree, and you are better off calling a professional, and in fact having that professional confirm that you do have polyphagous shot hole borer. And they usually stay up to date and know what the latest research has shown. So right now we have very few options for anybody. In a few months, we hope to have more. But there are a couple of insecticides that can be either sprayed on or injected, and it's best done by a licensed applicator.
Has there been any progress in containing these once we've discovered them? And your research right now, I know it's real new. Have you been able to contain what you found?
Well, you know, recently I actually was called to look at a infestation of another pest. There's a Diaprepes weevil.
Oh, could you tell us a little bit about that?
Why the Diaprepes pests? Weevil came in the late, I think the around 2008 or so. My memory is a little fuzzy. Anyway, this was a invasive exotic pest that was a major threat to citrus. The weevil spends most of its life cycle underground as grubs, and then the beetles, the adult beetles, emerge and climb up the tree and feed on the foliage and lay their eggs. And then the larvae are back down in the soil, feeding on roots and potentially girdling the trunk of the citrus tree. Actually, the host range of the Diaprepes weevil is quite wide. There are a lot of ornamentals. And Orange County had a major infestation in the Newport Beach area. And now Yorba Linda, it's actually spread through quite a bit of Orange County.
What does it look like for us to see?
The weevil is about maybe a little bit over an inch. And it only feeds at night, so the best way to know you have something going on is when the adults are feeding in the warmer months of the year, they tend to notch the leaves. So you'll see these little notches, like half circles, at the edges of the leaves. And that's a typical feeding pattern for this weevil. Or you might see trees starting to decline, and if you dig in the soil and find hundreds of grubs and roots that have been eaten, then there's a good chance it's Diaprepes weevil, but you should get that confirmed by an entomologist because there are a lot of grubs in the soil that don't kill trees.
Are there particular trees that they like better than other trees?
They love citrus. In fact, they're very destructive on citrus. They are commonly found on hibiscus and coral trees, pygmy date palms, things like that, where Raphiolepis. So quite a few trees and shrubs that we grow in the landscape. I was called out to look at a Diaprepes root weevil infestation because that's become widespread enough that the Department of Food and Agriculture no longer has a quarantine for it. And that was spread on greenways, by the way. quite easily. So the quarantine's over. They're now concentrating on Asian citrus psyllid. But it's the Diprepis weevil is still there. It's still causing damage, but it's not as big a threat as the Asian citrus psyllid and the citrus greening that it spreads.
You know, we have a few more minutes left. Could you just go by some of the things that we should be aware of?
Well, I just want to say that as I was going there to look at the Diprepis weevil, I looked at these trees and I saw the typical characteristic staining on very mature coral trees. And there were about 100 coral trees.
Oh.
And normally the Polyphagus shothole borer goes to a tree and, you know, build up to tremendous numbers on that tree before it moves. But in a monoculture like avocados, it actually will move through the growth fairly quickly. But in the landscape, it tends to go to a tree, build up to large numbers, and then move. In this situation, they had lines of these large, mature coral trees to this entry of this HOA. And it was a monoculture. So I saw beetles on quite a few of the trees, whereas normally I would expect to find it on one tree, and then it would move. This one was moving through these mature coral trees, which are very, very expensive. And we actually went in and recommended to the landscape management company and the HOA that they do a bark treatment with the insecticide and do an injection or so injection of a systemic insecticide, and then do some selective removal of infested branches. And I was just there a few weeks ago, and in the year since we did the treatments, those trees have really recovered. So if you can find this quickly and address the issue, there's a really good potential that you can prevent the problem. If I had gone to that location a year later, we may not have had the same result. If I've gone there 2 years later, I think all those trees would be dead.
Wow, really?
And that would have been hundreds of thousands of dollars of damage just in that one location.
So maybe one of our lessons today is go out and look at our trees in our yard and see really how healthy they are and take a good look and examine them, spend a bit of time with that. And then call for the appropriate help by an arborist.
Correct. Integrated pest management, which the University of California is known for, you need to know what a healthy plant looks like. If you know what a healthy plant looks like, and then you start seeing symptoms of stress, that is the time to try to find out what's wrong. And it could be a broken sprinkler head. It could be you're watering too much or not enough. But find out what's causing the problem. If you see obvious attack symptoms, then call somebody like the Agricultural Commissioner's office and ask them if you can send a sample in to get it identified. Or take good photographs and send them to the Agricultural Commissioner or to our UCCE Master Gardener hotline and see if you can get some idea of what the problem might be and what some management methods you might take to bring that tree back to good health. But it's really important that you know what a healthy tree looks like, and when you start seeing any signs of stress, that you start to, you can go to your retail nursery and find a certified nursery professional and show them pictures of it. One thing I will warn people about. If you have white flies or insects heavily covering your plant, if you take it to a retail nursery, please put it in a sealed plastic bag so that you don't infest them. Because the worst, I see this all the time, people walking into a nursery with a branch with bugs crawling all over it. Put it in a clear plastic bag, like a Ziploc, a large Ziploc, so that you don't infest them and that they can look through the bag and see what it is and then determine whether it's something common or something that needs to be sent to the agricultural commissioner or the Department of Food and Agriculture.
Yeah, I think that's probably good sense if you're going to be taking your disease plant anywhere. If you're going to be taking it to a nursery or if you're going to take it to a friend and say, hey, do you know what this is? To have it in a Ziploc bag so you don't give your friend and neighbor a disease in their yard that they didn't previously have. Wonderful. What is there any other pests that we should be aware of right now?
Right now, I'm starting to see the ants coming out.
Ants.
And ant control is really important because the Argentine ant in particular is going into trees and it's harvesting the honeydew from the sucking insects like the scales and the white flies. And what's happening is the ant, in order to get that, is disrupting the natural biocontrol. So we have ladybird beetles, green lace wings, a lot of different parasitoids that help to keep these soft-bodied sucking insects under control. And when ants find that these insects are up there with the honeydew that they crave, they will actually chase off or kill the natural enemies that are trying to control those pests.
Do you know we actually have a recording from this show of interviewing you last year about what to do about ants? So if any of our listeners would like to know a little bit more how to control ants and what to do, they could look at our website or they could go to the KUCI website and look under Thursday Mornings with Master Gardeners, and it'll be listed there also. And it's about a half-hour program talking about what to do about taking care of ants.
You know, the other thing to be aware of is we still have red imported fire ant. And when you have an ant problem and you're getting stung, that Argentine ants don't sting. Red imported fire ants do sting. Red imported fire ants are in Orange County. We have passed a fee assessment in Orange County. If you suspect you have red imported fire ant, if you were stung by an ant, or usually by many ants, but red imported fire ants, call up the Orange County Vector Control District, and they will collect the ants, identify it. If it is, in fact, a red imported fire ant, they will do the treatments because we are paying for it through our fee assessment. And because Orange County is one of the few counties that passed the fee assessment, we are the least infested of the counties that had fire ant populations. So that fee assessment and Orange County Vector Control, that program has been very effective at keeping the populations under control, but they will always be here.
They will always be here. It is not a free service, but you've already paid for it through your assessments. Mm-hmm. So when they come out, they'll not charge you an extra fee. It is given as being part of owning property here, and that is a wonderful way to get rid of those fire ants.
Correct, because they have... We have very effective materials to control it.
Okay. We have about 5 minutes left. What are your final thoughts and anything you would like to share with us?
Well, one of my real concerns right now is because of the mandatory water restrictions. It's fine if you let your turf go brown. We understand why we're doing that. One thing people need to be aware of is if you have trees and turf, and you turn your water off to the turf, you have just given that your tree a death sentence. So we need to conserve water, but you also need to remember that reinvigorating turf, especially a warm season turf grass, is easy to do by just adding more water. Once you drought stress a tree that has taken decades to grow, once you drought stress that tree is very likely going to die. So when you turn your water off for your turf grass, remember that every so often you should water your tree. And you could just put out a small sprinkler, you know, that attached to your hose, or a soaker. Soakers are really good for watering trees. Put get your soaker and put that around the drip line of the tree and let it slowly soak into the soil down to 1 or 2 feet. And just do that. You don't have to do that all the time, but just periodically do that to recharge the soil so you don't kill your tree. Because if you kill your tree, you're not going to be able to reinvigorate it. You're going to have to replace it. And trees are very important in terms of cooling the environment, intercepting rainwater so we don't have as much water runoff, and taking carbon out of the air, carbon dioxide out of the air. So trees are really important, and they will, if they're water stressed, they will be more subject to attack by different pests. But if you neglect to water them, they will die, and we will lose a valuable resource.
Thank you, Dr. Kawashima. We really appreciate you coming here today and spending time with us, and I know we'll be talking to you again more about when we find out more about what we can do about this pest that's affecting our campus and our community, and I hope you'll be back with us again with some updates on that. One of the things I pulled out of today is get to know your plants. Get to know them now to see, and what I mean by that is see how healthy they are. And then regularly inspect them. Our world is getting smaller. We're having more and more travel, and we're bringing more and more pests. And we would like to keep our beautiful backyards beautiful, if at all possible. And if there is a problem, do something about it sooner versus later. Does that pretty much wrap it up?
That's good. I got one last thing.
Wonderful. Thank you.
I always have one last thing. When you replace your lawn with California-friendly plants or native plant material, just remember that Mediterranean plants or California native plants have different water cycles and water needs, and you shouldn't mix the two. If you go with California natives, then try to make sure that water zone is all California natives or plants that can tolerate California native irrigation regimes. If you're planting Mediterranean plants, then know when they need to be watered and how much water they need. The other thing to realize is that a lot of these plants will take as much water as you give them, or they can survive on very little water. So know if you have that type of plant. If you have a plant like a ficus, if you water ficus, it'll take all the water you give it. If you drought stress ficus, then they will adapt. So know your trees. If you don't know, contact somebody who does know and find out what type of watering regime that plant can survive on. And that's going to be really important right now during this drought with the water restrictions.
Well, thank you very much, Doctor. I'd like to leave us with our website, which is www.ucccmg.com. And our hotline number, if you have any questions, is hotline@uccemg.com. It's a really friendly and knowledgeable group of people, and we threw a lot of information out to you today, and we don't expect you to digest it all at one sitting. So feel free to give us an email, contact us, and we'll help you out however we can. Thank you again for being with us, Dr. Kawashima. I appreciate it. And I thank our listeners, and I hope everybody has a wonderful day. Thank you. Bye-bye.